Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Australian and New Zealand Studies channel on the New Books Network. I'm Bede Haynes, and before we begin today's interview, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners and custodians of the land in which I live and pay my respects to the elders, the stories and the traditions past, present and future. Today, I'm speaking with Stuart Kells. Stuart is an adjunct professor at La Trobe Business School, part of La Trobe University, in Victoria. Stuart was awarded a PhD from Monash University and has had several other roles, including a research fellow at Melbourne University's Institute of Applied Economics and Social Research, a member of Monash University's Centre for Regulatory Studies, roles in the Victorian Department of Premier and Cabinet, the Victoria Auditor General's Office, and as an economist at accountancy firms PBB Advisory and KPMG. And additionally, and probably most pleasing for those of us listening to this podcast channel, Stuart is an accomplished and prize-winning author of several genres: social history, science, literary history, economic and business history, and most recently, fiction. Today's book is called The Convent, A City Finds Its Heart, published in 2020 by an imprint of the Melbourne University Press. And picking up from the back of the book, it reads, "The Abbotsford Convent was this haunted place, left to languish for years after the last of the Sisters of the Good Shepherd had gone. In its prime, it had been a school, a refuge, a retreat, a workhouse, and a prison, the single largest charitable institution in the Southern Hemisphere. In the late 1990s, there was a proposed high-density development which threatened the idyllic riverside location, sparking outrage in the local community and further afield. Years of protesting, negotiating, fundraising followed, and the convent now, on Australia's National Heritage List, has started a new life as a vibrant centre for art and culture." So this is the book in which Stuart Kells tells this story. Now, Stuart, good afternoon and thank you for coming along today.
Thanks, Pete. It's an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
Great. I'll begin with a traditional opening question for these podcasts. Why did you decide to write this book?
It's a really good question. I knew aspects of this story going back into the first years of the BRACS government in Victoria. So in the early 2000s, I was working in the Department of Premier and Cabinet when this came up as a possible opportunity to turn the site into a community asset. I think Richard Wynne was Parliamentary Secretary to the Premier at the time, and also the local member, and he was a very important participant on the government side. And he and I had adjacent offices in the Premier's office building, and I saw a few briefs and submissions come by. So I was aware of the campaign in that period, And then maybe about 10 years later, I joined the board of the convent once it had been established as a community arts and cultural precinct. And I've been on the board for more than 5 years now. About, I'd say, 4 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, the idea of having a history of the convent written came up, in part because some of the key people involved in the campaign were elderly, including some of the nuns, and because the full story hadn't really been captured or told. And I think it was a natural question, natural answer to the question of who to get to write it when you have an author on the board. And so I spoke to people like Charlotte Allen, who'd been one of the key early campaigners, and began the research and did detailed interviews with some of the key players in the coalition that first ran the community campaign, and also former developers and board members and politicians and other people, and over a period of about 2 years, captured the story.
Excellent. Well, for those who aren't familiar with Melbourne, and people listening to this will be based in other countries as well, could you please let me know and locate this place called Abbotsford within Melbourne, giving a sense of its flavour, its urban flavour, demographics, the desirability to live there, and whether it's a place that's undergone some form of gentrification?
Sure. Yes, well, like most inner suburbs in major cities in Australia, it's been a bit of a roller coaster, an economic and a cultural roller coaster for Abbotsford. In the very early days, so in the 1830s into the 1840s, when Melbourne was first established as a city, it was one of the first areas of land release, and it was a very desirable area. So you had gentlemen farmlets owned by key industrialists and politicians and lawyers, judges, and it's described as a sort of the Toorak of the period, which is a very desirable suburb. But if you fast forward to after the gold rush of the 1850s in Victoria, it became a very very much the opposite, a more dangerous and less desirable area. Lots of small houses and a lot of poverty, little factories like soap factories and abattoirs and things, and it was a bit of a rough area. At a time when Melbourne was growing incredibly fast and there was a very significant urban poor. If you fast forward to now, I think the cycle's changed again, and it's a pretty desirable area right on the edge of the inner suburbs, right near the Yarra River. It's in this nice crossover between being adjacent to the east to Kew, which is a very desirable area, to Richmond towards the south, Fitzroy and Collingwood to the west, and Alphington and Fairfield, etc., to the north. So it's a very desirable part of Melbourne now, and you can imagine those sort of little workers' cottages and weatherboard and rendered brick cottages have all been renovated, or most of them have been renovated. The factories have turned into factory conversions. So it's a lovely area. And part of the reason why this campaign was kicked off in the first place to capture this space in public hands was concern over overbuilding along the Yarra River. So it was a time when there weren't many apartments along that stretch of the river, and there wasn't a lot of building, but there was a concern that this site would become essentially a gated community with towers, etc. And that would have been a big loss of public space. And that particular aspect of the campaign was very prescient, because if you look at that area now, particularly further south in Richmond, near where the Victoria Gardens shopping centre is, and that part of Abbotsford on the south side, it's very, very heavily built with large apartment blocks and large shopping centres and things. So it was very timely. But yeah, it's a unique place in Melbourne because it's quite close to the CBD. It's only about 4 kilometres from the centre of the city, but it has this really rural sort of feel because it's at the bottom of a sort of green wedge that follows the winding course of the Yarra River up towards towards the northeast and ultimately into the Yarra Valley. If you go there and to the main entrance of the common, you look around, all you see is eucalypts, and there's this semicircle of bushland that surrounds the site and has been there for forever. So it is this really interesting mixture of urban and bush.
Okay. Now, a more local question. For those who live there, is it the Collingwood Magpies or the Richmond Tigers? Who's favoured?
That's a really good question. I think it'd be very much more the Magpies than the Tigers in general. North side of the river, much more likely to be Magpies. But it's a very good question. And those allegiances don't necessarily follow very, very closely the suburban boundaries anymore. The economics of living in Collingwood, 20 or 30 years ago, living in Collingwood was an interesting proposition. It was a pretty rough area even then, but now it's very much the opposite. So I'm not sure that there are super and large numbers of Collingwood fans actually in Collingwood. Good question.
Excellent. Now, one other introductory question. The land itself, Abbotsford, you tell the story in the book of how Abbotsford, the land was named Abbotsford, and that name itself derives from the name of Walter Scott's farm. And it refers to a ford that was used by monks, so a ford by abbots. And there's something interesting about this imagery because Walter Scott was a Scottish churchman, as I understand it, but he's said to have had some Catholic leanings. And then years later, there was a bunch of nuns who we'll come to in a second, came across the oceans, forded the oceans, to come to live at a place called Abbotsford. So there seems to be something serendipitous almost in that name and the people who came to live there.
I think you're 100% right, and I'm very cued to those questions of names and etymology. Yes, it was a really interesting coincidence that and it makes sense, obviously, but that the word itself had that religious connotation. But the way it came to Melbourne was entirely secular. So it was a house built by a chap called John Orr in the 1840s, so very early in the history of Melbourne. He was a local commercial and political figure, and he took the name from the house that you mentioned, but it was very much a private home and a grand colonial-style private home on the Abbotsford Peninsula, and only later, 20 years later, did it have a religious connotation again in Melbourne. So, yeah, there's definitely some interesting serendipity there. But the neighbouring house, which also had a religious name, St Heliers, and which was also initially a secular house, the nuns who bought Abbotsford House also had their eye on the neighbouring St Heliers building. It is said that they did a lot of praying and even standing up religious icons to aid their campaign to acquire the neighbouring property, which was ultimately successful. And for a long time, the convent was known as St Heliers as well as Abbotsford Convent.
Yes, it's interesting. Now, we'll get to the nuns in a second, but there's one question I want to ask first. The book itself, for those who come to read the book, they'll find that it weaves two stories together. The first is the story of the local community, essentially from prehistory through to the convent. And then there are other chapters which deal with the community's efforts to try and preserve this land. And what I wanted to ask was the aspects about the convent and the history of the land are written in the way in which a historian might write it. It takes an objective viewpoint. And when it comes to the community group parts of the story, there's a sense, in at least as I read the book and I'm reading along, of there's more investment by the author of the book into the cause of the people trying to preserve the land. It's not criticizing it as side-taking or anything like that, but there's just two, one way is almost, it's almost like a documentary following the community group around. So you really feel for them and you feel for the wins and losses they have along the way, which stands in contrast to the much more objective historical view of the convent life. Was that a deliberate choice that was made when you were preparing this book?
That's a really good question. So the idea of having the two interwoven stories was certainly a deliberate choice. And the reason why I did that is because there really are multiple stories to be told about that site. There's the long history, the indigenous, and then the colonial and conventual histories, and then the history as essentially a university campus, but also the story of the campaign itself, which had multiple stages and facets. So I deliberately tried to interweave those. And the latter story, the story about the campaign, it's relatively unusual to have this kind of documentary record in that sort of detail of a community campaign. They're an important aspect of social history, but they often don't get documented. They often don't succeed as well. So that was entirely deliberate. The tone or the perspective that you touched on, I'm not sure. I think partly what you might be detecting, particularly in the campaign, is that I really stood shoulder to shoulder in writing that with some of the key figures in the campaign itself. So through the interviews, and I had really good and deep engagement with the people who led the campaign. So I'm sure part of that is their voices speaking through that part. But yeah, I personally found it quite an emotional project, and I think it's fair to say I was emotionally invested both in the conventual story and in the campaign. And you do feel that there are those sort of highs and lows of both phases, but particularly with the campaign, it's a bit of an emotional roller coaster. I've tried to be objective and factual, and it is that, and it's very much based on interviews and archival research, but there probably is a bit of the passion peeking through either from myself or from the people that I've been researching with.
Yeah, no, I felt that emotion. It reminded me in a way of the Mike Moore documentary, Roger and Me. I don't know if you've seen that about Flint, Michigan, and you feel the in that case, the filmmaker really brings the reader or the viewer in that case into the story. And that's what I found this book did. You actually brought the reader into this community group, and you got a sense of a world I personally had never been involved in. And I've really felt that.
Oh, thank you. That's a great observation. And that's very much the intention, is to bring the reader into those moments, literally sitting around the kitchen table and planning these things, or that moment with the billionaires sitting around on stools in the farm shed at the children's farm, planning fundraising, those sorts of things. Some amazing moments and turning points in the campaign. And yeah, part of what I tried to do was to capture those in convincing detail, so that the reader could really feel and experience those moments and that emotional roller coaster. But in the conventual period as well, it's very sad. I mean, there were, a lot of positives about what the nuns were trying to do, but also there were, terrible experiences for people who were in the convent. So, I've tried to capture that in its richness.
Yeah, well, that's great. Now, a couple of questions. We'll get on to the nuns now. Who are the Sisters of the Good Shepherd?
Well, they've gone through all sorts of different phases as well. But they began as a religious order in France, this particular group of nuns came over here from Ireland, although it was a French order. They came over here in 1863. With the idea of setting up a convent that was an office of the order in Melbourne. As I touched on before, it was a time in Melbourne when there was really rapid social change post-gold rush. Population was growing very quickly. There was a very significant urban poor a lot of young women in particular in very difficult circumstances. And it's important to sort of understand that the different Catholic orders at the time had different philosophies and different histories. So there were religious orders in Melbourne at the time, including Catholic religious orders, who did minister to the poor. But for the most part, they had concepts of looking after what you might think of in those days as the deserving poor, and not what they called, with this very nebulous and loaded language, not, quote, fallen women. And it was the fallen women in particular who needed the most help, noting that fallen women included a very, very wide range of different people, from people who were from, bad marriages, or people who were pregnant out of marriage, people who were forced into sex work, alcoholics, criminals, and all sorts of different kinds of people in all sorts of different kinds of circumstances. And there was this large population of people who really weren't being supported through religious orders and through charities. And they were the focus very much of this order, that they would essentially welcome all comers and on a large scale. And so it was, in some ways, it was ideal for Melbourne at the time. But as I touched on before, the flip side of that, though, was that the way that they engaged with people once inside was pretty harsh and pretty austere. They had all sorts of ethics, for example, about not talking about people's history. Once you came into the convent, your history was gone, and there was no discussion of what had happened to you, in the days and weeks immediately before. And that was very hard. Imagine young women who've recently had a miscarriage, or recently given birth and given up their child, or people who'd been in abusive marriages, or had been forced into sex work. You can imagine going into a place where you're safe and you are supported, but there's no kind of, emotional support. They frowned on people creating friendships. There were all sorts of different divisions within the convent of different types of inmates, and they really couldn't engage with each other. So it was a very harsh and austere environment. The nuns had an ethos of not physically touching the Magdalens and the inmates and the different kinds of people that came there, which obviously has the positive side to that, but there's also a negative side around, the lack of emotional support and that kind of thing. Mm. So very, very difficult. But yeah, so they were an international religious order, and that became one of their largest facilities in the Southern Hemisphere, and it became a really important part of Melbourne. So one of the first things they had to do was decide how to be viable and how to be, financially sustainable. And so they set up a farm. They did lace work and other things. They did a lot of fundraising and held very big events, including at the exhibition buildings. And ultimately, one of their most important economic industries was that they set up a very big laundry. And this wasn't unusual in the order or in other large Catholic facilities to essentially run a laundry. And so they were a laundry to some of the major hospitals and also to some businesses and local families. And they did this literally on an industrial scale. And so you can imagine if you're a young woman or a lady who's left a difficult marriage, and suddenly you put to work in the laundry, and they worked very hard. There was all sorts of terrible stories about industrial accidents and people being worked very hard, and the nuns themselves worked incredibly hard as well. And there was a real ethos in the convent of self-sufficiency. So the women did, they did all the gas connections, they did a lot of the shoemaking and driving the tractors, which for some women was a great, a way to essentially escape the social strictures of the time and to engage in those kinds of occupations and, in a sense, professional work. But for some people, it was very grueling, and there are accusations of people being sort of overworked and those sorts of things as well. So a real sort of mixed blessing, I would say.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, so I was going to I'll comment on some of those points you've made there. I'll ask you your views on a few things. The first is you've made that observation that the fallen women, as they were called, were the ones who this order attracted, which seems to be a noble gesture on behalf of the order as opposed to the deserving poor. And they were welcomed into the convent was the way it was expressed. But could you comment on one aspect of the book which I found quite puzzling, but I imagine it was standard in the day, was that it was essentially a prison. Women could be sentenced there under legislation to work there or to be inmates there for a certain period of time, almost as though it was a jail of sorts. Can you explain that system in Victoria, or I imagine across Australia, and how that came to be?
Yes. So there's lots of different parts of the convent and different reasons why someone might be in there. Some women went there in order to become nuns and to take holy orders, and so they would go through a particular track. Some women went in there essentially for penitential reasons, to try and, you know, reform their lives, and they had certain strictures around them as well. Some people were in there because essentially they were wards of the state, and it was a bit like a kind of a juvenile prison. So that they would be sentenced to go and you know, be wards of the wards in the convent, to work in the industrial school, and to be you know, that they were kept there. So the idea of them being prisoners and inmates is accurate. Some people went there because it was a normal school. There were children who went there as school children just for the day, and some people went there as orphans because they ran an orphanage. So there are all sorts of different reasons why people were there. The people who were wards of the state literally were, in a sense, in jail. But even some of the other women there, like the Magdalens, there's a custodial aspect of that as well. And some of them didn't like it. And they literally escaped by climbing the wall at night and running off into the you know, local area. There are all sorts of different kinds of escape stories from the convent. Some of them quite accurate, some of them exaggerated, and for political and sectarian reasons and other reasons. But fundamentally, the ethos was, you know, if you're in the convent, you're in the convent, and it was life behind the wall. You'd made a commitment. The nuns said a lot of times that that women who were there, not as wards of the state, but as penitents or others, had the right to leave. But I think it's fair to say that it wasn't super easy to leave, and that there were different kinds of pressures on women about whether they could easily leave once they'd made a commitment to different kinds of tracks.
Yes, with the, you mentioned sec, Well, there's an excellent chapter in the book on escape, so I'll leave that for people to read, but there are some very strange stories about how the women leave or the young ladies leave and end up in neighbors' houses, and police and nuns turn up to grab them back by the collar, and it just seems so strange. But what I wanted to ask was, another point you touched on was the sectarianism, and there was some I got the sense in reading it that a lot of the records you referred to had to actually be viewed as potentially being sectarian exaggerations of things. But there was one criticism that came through from some of the locals in the area, was that because this was a convent and a religious charity, they got government subsidies, so they didn't have to pay, I think, for water, which must be a massive benefit if you're running a commercial laundry, not to have to pay for water costs. And there was a complaint that the Magdalen Laundry was run for profit, even though the profit might have been channeled into a charitable type institution. But the downside that caused was that there were other people within the local area working in other commercial laundries, and those laundries lost any ability to be able to compete. What are your views on that?
Yes, so you've touched on a lot there. There were certainly allegations that the laundry was operating at non-commercial rates, and that they had free labour, and that they were undercutting commercial laundries and that kind of thing. And there may be an element of truth in that. The laundries were open to inspection by the state, and they were regularly inspected by government people. The leading nuns protested a lot of this and said, well, actually their pricing was higher than the commercial laundries, and that they really relied on things like existing relationships with hospitals and the decisions of individual families, etc., to be viable. So I think the larger point, though, is where are these criticisms coming from? And I think it's 100% the case, and it's quite well established, that a lot of the criticisms were really based on that old conflict, which really doesn't come up these days very much, but the Catholic-Protestant conflict. And if you run your mind back to the 19th century in Australia, concepts of the British Empire were very strong, Anglicanism was the religion of the British monarchy and the British state and the British Empire. And there was a suspicion that people who had loyalty to Rome and to Catholicism were essentially not very British. So there's that kind of question of loyalty. And then there was an association of Catholicism with essentially being Irish. And there were all sorts of prejudices against the Irish at that time. The Irish were obviously in situations of poverty, and a lot of Irish people came to Australia to escape poverty. And there was a real connotation of Catholicism with being Irish. So the convent was a real lightning rod for anti-Catholic thinking. And so you had, and I'm saying this from the perspective of someone who grew up half Protestant, half Catholic, so I don't have an allegiance to either side in particular. You had people who were real Protestant activists, essentially spreading stories around the sweating of labour in the laundry, all these supposed subsidies that they were getting, how it was inappropriate for women to be driving tractors, that sort of thing. And it was a major public controversy. And as I said, the government sent inspectors there, the Protestant associations sent inspectors there. And through all of that, the convent, the order was able to really rebut a lot of that criticism, and to show that it was essentially nonsense. And one of the key figures in the campaign against the convent at that time, it was ultimately branded by the police as a bit of a crackpot, but the sort of stuff that they were saying found a ready audience, as you can imagine, because people love controversy, and there were all sorts of different feelings about Catholic enterprises. So I was very careful to write that part of the book to say, well, yes, there were harsh conditions. Yes, it was relying on, in a sense, unpaid labour to do this. But the flip side of that is that a lot of the criticisms were really either exaggerated or were made up. And I think it's important to put that in context.
Mm. Now, I've a couple more questions before we move on to the community action. The first is if you look in the index, I'll start this. If you look up the word Mary in the index, there's a whole list of nuns called Mary, and they've got this funny characteristic predominantly of they're all Sister Mary, Saint something, but the Saint something often is a man's name. Saint Mary, Saint Joseph, Mary, Saint Thomas Aquinas. For two things. One, do you know why that approach was taken? And secondly, would that have meant they had to be called, say, if they were Sister Mary, Saint Joseph, would they have just been Sister Joseph because you couldn't call everyone Sister Mary and it would take a lot of words to say Sister Mary, Saint Joseph every time?
That's a really good question. And it is an unusual convention. I honestly don't know how they referred to each other on a day-to-day basis in the 19th century, but certainly later on they weren't all called Mother Mary or Sister Mary. They did mix it up a bit. But, yeah, of the first four nuns that came, there was Mother Mary and then three Sisters Mary. It would have been a little bit awkward to call everyone Mary. They have those secondary names, so Sister Mary of St. Thomas Aquinas or Sister Mary of St. Francis, etc. I think the reason why they were male names wasn't particularly because they were choosing male names, but more that they were saints and patriarchs. And it's interesting that the nuns, in a sense, lost their prior name, but the names were still known to people as well. So there wasn't a full sort of erasing of their prior identity. But really good question. I'm not sure how they managed that on a practical level.
Mm. And by the mid-1970s, the society had changed. Welfare wasn't necessarily done through religious institutions anymore, and Vatican II had come along, and you explained how the order itself divided into it seems to be a conservative arm and a more liberal arm, and eventually they left the land and we come ultimately the movement. But one thing, before the nuns leave the land, I'd like your view on this. You tell through in the book, especially in the early 1900s, the sisters arrange a fair and they raise a lot of money, and through a lot of this charitable work and raising money is how the actual buildings are built. They're paid for through these type of activities. And is there a sense almost a sense of sort of community justice that since the community of this area, Richmond, Collingwood, etc., has paid for so many decades and decades for this institution and for this land's maintenance, whether that's in itself a reason why this land should be considered a community asset, even though the donors never actually owned anything in it, but it has just been such a community effort for so long?
Yeah, that's a really good point. It's something I don't really draw out in the book, but it's definitely a good point. The sort of fundraising that they did in that conventual era was much broader than just, the Abbotsford and Collingwood sort of area. It was right across Melbourne and Victoria. And they had these, as I said, these massive charity events where you'd have the governor and others come along. There was a big public investment and a big community investment in the buildings. And the buildings were, very, very well built, well designed, large, Italianate and Gothic structures. So in a sense, there was a public stake in them, but also the site itself, it's public open space in large part with beautiful gardens and meadows right on the Yarra River, right in the middle of the city. So to the extent that there was a sense of public ownership of the site, as much as anything, it was of the grounds and the environs around it, right? So after the convent was closed and after it ceased to be a college campus, it was essentially boarded up and walled up for a while. But people still went there. They climbed through cracks in the wall and over fences and things, or around the riverside. And they used the gardens. They took cuttings from the gardens. They used the open space. They played games on the old tennis courts and, you know, explored the buildings. So even before it was handed in a formal sense to the community, there was a strong sense of community ownership, partly because of its riverside location, partly because of that important access, you know, to the paths and things. But, yeah, I think you're right. And also there's that historical investment in the site. I think that's valid.
Right. Now, when I was reading through the book, I was trying to follow the land ownership at points in time, and it seemed that the religious order owned the land from the late 1800s until about the 1970s, and it then seems to have come into the possession of the educational institution that ultimately became La Trobe University. And then in the 1990s, and this is what weaves in the second series of chapters, the community story, a developer, Australand, comes along with plans to redevelop the site. I'd like you to explain, if you could, what right did Australand had to actually start throwing around its designs for this site? Because it seems never to have actually owned it, but it almost dealt with the land like it was going to own it.
Yeah, good question. So just walking up to some of those land ownership points. So yes, more or less the whole of the area was owned by the nuns up until the mid-1970s. At the time when they sold it, I think the children's farm was carved out around that time, and that became in itself a municipal and community space, so just the farm. The rest of it went to two institutions. One was, a nursing college, and one was an early childhood institution. And through the university reforms, et cetera, I think both of those went to two different universities. I think the University of Melbourne and La Trobe University both had colleges on the site, and the University of Melbourne still has a foothold there with their early learning centre across the road from the main entrance of the convent. Once the universities left the scene, essentially the land came under the control of a public development agency, which was the Urban Land Corporation. Went through all sorts of different incarnations, but it's more or less the Urban Land Corporation. And it was a highly commercial entity. This is in the Jeff Kennett era of Victoria. So it was all about, you know, development and private investment and, you know, private spaces. And so they ran a tender. I think as a result of that, the reason why Australand had a stake is because they were the preferred proponent. And it was only quite late in that process that this really came to light in the community. And Australand, you know, started notifying people in the immediate vicinity of the convent, notifying local residents. And they said, oh, hang on a second, what's this? And the Australand proposal was for something like 289 residential units to be built, partly by rebuilding inside the large old convent buildings, but also by building townhouses and low-rise buildings around the edge and around the river and that kind of thing. And then a 10-story or so tower on the north side of St. Helier's Street, so just on the northern side of the site. And the local people said, well, hang on a second. And a very astute member of the local council said to them, well, actually, this is not entirely done and dusted, because there's a municipal step where for this to actually go ahead, even though Australand are good to go, and even though the Urban Land Corporation and the government are good to go, there is actually a step where the community can object through the local council process. And that's exactly what they did. They quickly organised. This is at the end of 1997. And they quickly held large meetings of local residents and engaged in a formal sense with the council process. which allowed them to slow everything down and to really start a whole different track of public hearings and, a multi-track consideration of different kinds of proposals for the site.
Yes, well, so we get to the, as you said, we get to the 1990s and the convent has been boarded up. It's a bit overgrown. The community still uses the area. Word spreads that Australand is looking to develop, and then the community group springs up. And there are, the book draws out three or four important aspects of a community movement. I'm going to mention there's three or four I'm going to mention now, and then I'd like you to comment on how important it is for all of these elements to come together. The first is that you need people who are actually dedicated, and there are, you go through the names, and some names as Nigel Lewis, Joe Kinross, Sally Romanes, I think I've said that correctly, and a whole bunch of these locals who really dedicate themselves to trying to preserve this site. That's what seems to be the first thing. The second point is the book, you make the point that it's not enough just to oppose something. You actually need to have your own vision, and your own vision essentially has to be the vision that wins out to be what's actually wanted. And then there's a third element, which is, or seems to be almost luck, where you need to have all luck, or sort of luck that's worked for in a way, where you get the support of the right people at the right time. And there's two aspects to this. The first is, there are these famous, very rich philanthropists, including from Rupert Murdoch's family. His mother, Dame Elizabeth Murdoch, I think it's his sister, Anne Cantor. There's Lynn Williams, the widow of a famous Australian artist, Fred Williams. There's all these people who can have profile, who can raise money, and who are interested in saving this site. And then there's another element of, I'd like you to comment on this. It seems to be luck in that, there's a man in the Labor Party called Steve Brax, who in the 1990s is not in power, but ends up in 1999 becoming the Premier, and his wife especially is supportive of this movement. So it's almost as though you need all these elements to come together and to get a successful campaign, which in one view is admirable for these people, but in another view is, you think, far out, this is what a hill to get over. If this is what it takes to save something, you need all of this to happen, and you only just get there in the end by the skin of your teeth.
No, that's a really good point. It's, in some ways, this is a template for other campaigns, but yeah, you're right. The flip side of that is, God, it shows how difficult it can be. I describe it as fractal. There's so many different aspects to it, and it really is using these networks. So going through your question, yeah, those people that you mentioned are definitely some of the key people in the campaign, and they took it very, very seriously. They committed to it as a full-time thing, some of them, and they worked on it in a very professional and serious way for about 8 years. So it wasn't just a sort of a side project. They made it their main thing, and they were very diligent about keeping notes, writing to people, and, you know, jumping through the formal hoops in the right way. They took it very seriously. You mentioned the point around the positive solution. I think that's so crucial. If they had just said, no, we don't like it, we don't like it, but there's no real sort of solution, that wouldn't have worked. But you can imagine, in order to put up a positive solution and a viable solution, that in itself creates all sorts of other difficulties. And I describe the campaign as going through a series of phase shifts, where they really started off as this sort of ground root, sort of grassroots, groundswell, local objectors and community activists, and then quickly became proponents or participants in a formal planning process, but then proponents of a social enterprise where they're actually, they became developers as well. They were rival developers with a different kind of vision for the site, social developers. And then they became, stewards of the site and ultimately, managers and landlords. So each one of those was an important shift, and you've got to have a lot of depth and flexibility to actually pull that off. And this is why a lot of these campaigns fail, because they just can't do that. They don't have that continuity. They don't have that agility. And you talk about, you know, the kinds of people that they brought into it. I think this was a really, really important part of their success, which is that it wasn't political. So, you know, their natural disposition was, you know, left, progressive, you know, inner urban, and they had good connections with the Labor Party, including Mary Delahunty, who helped put the convent on the ALP platform before that election, before the 1999 election that you mentioned. But they made sure that they had good relationships also with the Liberal Party, particularly with some key people and local members of the Liberal Party, and the Greens and the local council and big business and the professional services. You know, they had, you know, real estate agents, you know, gifting them, you know, office space and free advertising. They had major philanthropists like Dame Elizabeth Murdoch, as you mentioned, and members of her family really got behind it in a big way. Other major corporates and philanthropists, and partly benefiting from, as I said, being right next to Kew as well as right next to Collingwood. And they were able to mobilise that. They kept a list of people. I think they called them the great and the good, more or less that. And it was people like, you know, Barry Jones and Sam Neill and Stephanie Alexander, Michelle Quigley, and, you know, important public figures who had public profile. And, you know, all of it came back to the compelling story of this very special place and the idea that, you know, do you really want to put a fence around it, and do you really want to, you know, dismantle these buildings and close off this open space, or do you want to keep this as a community asset given how special it is? So it all came back to a very compelling proposition, which is to protect and maintain the site in community hands. But yeah, there was a lot of ingredients that were really important in why it succeeded, and therefore, you know, in some sense, hard to replicate in another campaign.
Yes, and I was going to actually, in relation to another campaign, a couple of points you mentioned there, and I'm loath to give away all the elements in the story, because it does actually, in the end, I think it's just worth reading to actually absorb in the way in which this site is ultimately preserved, rather than just say it in a few minutes over a conversation. But with the site itself, so you have the inner city neighbourhood, and it does seem to be, on my reading of it, it seems to have a left wing lean, and I imagine that it would be relatively filled with well-educated people through school and perhaps tertiary mostly, mm-hmm. moderately high disposable income, politically left-leaning, a lot of non-religious households, I imagine, and who the sort of people who love a challenge and who can get into it. Does that mean that these type of campaigns would almost be unable to be I should also say, I imagine these people have a little bit of influence around the place. And so if there's a similar site that's out in the boondocks of a city, does that in a way make it so much harder for this sort of social community issue to actually be carried through in those type of areas?
It's a really good question. I think it certainly doesn't exclude that, but you know, if it was a development that, you know, that was planned, you know, in essentially a much less well-off area with people with much less influence, I think you'd probably have to rely more on the sort of the raw power of democracy, you know, in terms of large numbers of people and the political process. But ultimately, it would come down to, you know, a compelling business case, in a sense, that a compelling case for what you were trying to preserve and why and how. I would be still reasonably optimistic. You know, in any kind of community, you're going to get people who will step up as leaders. In any kind of community, you're going to get people who will devote themselves to the extent they can. But I think it probably was the case that there were more people in that area who could give more of themselves to it, and they had a diversity of experience and, you know, mixtures of social and professional networks and that kind of thing. But I wouldn't want you to get the impression that the people who led the campaign were, you know, somehow kind of, you know, particularly wealthy or, you know, superly well connected. I think at the beginning they were just, you know, essentially local residents, not living high or anything like that. And they just saw that this was a really, really important, you know, call to action. And it's only after that that they really mobilized and built that larger network. And they did all sorts of clever things, including using the media, using billboards, and calling into radio programs. You know, there's well-known radio journalists in Melbourne would regularly have them on, you know, repeating the key messages. They had desks on the bike path all the time with flyers. They sat down in front of, you know, important you know, community sites, and they had tables at supermarkets and shopping centres, just reminding people that this was a campaign and that it was still, you know, unresolved. And ultimately they used a few strong-arm tactics like sending goats and other animals down to Parliament House to remind parliamentarians that they needed to make a decision about the whole site. So, you know, I don't think it was that there was a sort of a lot of money behind it as such. I think it was a really compelling case. You had people who were very committed and they were able to build and then mobilise that network. But the reason why people joined in wasn't because they saw some sort of personal advantage in it or that some sort of, you know, economic benefit. They joined because they thought it was a really compelling story.
Hmm. And the point you make, one of the points you make in the book is the site, and I imagine it's still the case, the site itself has to earn its keep. So it can't, it's not just given over to people just to go and do what they want with. It has to be maintained. There are leases, as I understand it, and there needs to be a synchronicity between all of the uses of the site. This has to have to make it actually a place that people want to go. So is that the case? Does it actually have to earn its keep still?
Yes, that's definitely the case. So the site itself is you know, grouped with some important other cultural institutions in Melbourne, like the Botanic Gardens and the zoo and, you know, the Arts Centre and the NGV. But its governance and its ownership and its funding are very different. It's owned by the community. It doesn't get ongoing operating funding from any government. And so it has to be self-sustaining. And there's all sorts of different ways that it does that, through tenancy income, through events, through car parking, through donations and philanthropic support from people in the community. It doesn't get ongoing government funding. It's had a few capital works grants over the years and things like that, and gets, you know, some money for specific events and that kind of thing through the arts funding system from, you know, on a sort of one-off basis. But it doesn't get ongoing funding like the zoo does or the Botanic Gardens or anything like that. So it's an important public asset, but it's funded very differently. And, you know, so that means that the way it's run has to be, you know, very, very careful and very commercial in a sense. The trick for the owners and the operators is always to walk that tightrope between, on the one hand, being viable and sustainable, but on the other hand, you know, maintaining the whole rationale for keeping the site in community ownership, which is that it's not, you know, it doesn't have a, you know, fast food restaurants, and it's not, you know, hyper commercial. It doesn't have, you know, housing on it. So to really keep to the spirit and to the essence of the mandate, which is to run it as a public asset, as a community asset, you know, that's what they do. And obviously, in the time of COVID in particular, that's been extremely difficult because of you know, the drop in visitation and events and all that. So they've had like a lot of arts and cultural organisations, they've had a pretty tough sort of year, but they're getting through it, and it's in their bones to, you know, and going right back to the beginning, it's in their bones to fight for viability and to, you know, to make it work.
Yep. Now, the book has two photographic sections. The first relates to the convent life and the second relates to the developed life of the site. The first are in black and white, and it has a real regimented feel. None of the people look particularly happy, and why would you, working in some of those conditions? And then in the second set of photos, it shows the modern life that's in the site. Color is introduced and there's vibrancy, there's artistic works. Was that a deliberate choice, and was there a sense of trying to show that the site, one, is still alive, but in the second way, it's almost come back to life?
Well, it's a really good question. It's not quite as stark as that. I think one of the reasons why a lot of the pictures in the earlier section are black and white is because they are actually black and white pictures because they're early. But yeah, it does work. And from a production point of view, you know, you probably know this already, but you either have a black and white section or you have a color section. You generally don't have them mixed. So it just turned out that the more modern photos tended to be color and the earlier ones were black and white mostly. But it does tell a story, as you say, about the kind of, you know, the austere period, and some of those early photos of, you know, the girls all lined up with their hands behind their heads, or, you know, walking around in those courtyards. It's a real kind of, you know, extreme institutional sort of vibe. You know, there's rows and rows of beds and desks and that kind of thing. So the black and white does sort of support that mood of being, you know, kind of institutional, bleak. And yes, the modern convent has a very different vibe. It really is about activation and community outreach and colour through art and through performance and through, you know, making things on the site. So, I think probably it's a serendipitous alignment of the necessities of production, but also, you know, the story.
Yeah. Well, that's excellent. Well, thank you, Stuart. We need to finish up pretty soon. So I'd like to ask you what your next projects are. What's in the pipeline?
Sure. I'm working on a book about water markets at the moment. Some research on irrigation markets, which sounds a little bit kind of lateral, but it's an important public policy story. And I've been writing a bit in that space with a co-author, Scott Hamilton, and he and I have already published a bit of our work in that area on the Murray-Darling Basin Plan, etc. I'm working on an institutional history of one of the large international law firms at the moment. I'm interested in the history of the professions, and that one's well underway. And a couple of other histories further down the track. I think it's always good to have a pipeline and to know what you're going to be doing in the next 12 to 18 months or so. And, I've got a couple of others further down the track as well, including one on it's essentially a what they call fintech, so financial technology history, and a couple of others as well. So, it's going to be a busy couple of years.
Well, thank you for coming along today. I've enjoyed this conversation. I certainly enjoyed the book. It's called The Convent, A City Finds Its Heart, and it's by Stuart. So thank you very much, Stuart Kells, for coming.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed talking to you. It was great and much appreciated.
My pleasure. Thank you. This has been the Australian channel of the New Books Network, and that was Stuart Kells, author of The Convent, A City Finds Its Heart, which is available now, and it is worth reading. Thank you.